go across Sullivan's Gulch without even thinking you're on a bridge, and that there were so many connectors between East and West Side. And now we just kind of take it for granted. It's either a major bridge or not. Yeah. So that was nice. Yeah. It was very informative. So thank you both. And Labor Radio will be back again next Monday at 6:00 to 6:30. And we thank our listeners for tuning in. And we'll see you again. Good night.
Thank you, Lane.
Thank you all both.
Bye-bye.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime, and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Karen James. My guest is Laura Speer, Associate Director for Policy Reform Advocacy at the Annie E. Casey Foundation. Over 5 million children nationwide have had an incarcerated parent. The loss of a parent through incarceration can have lasting effects on a child's development and well-being. In April 2016, the Annie E. Casey Foundation proposed recommendations for state and local policymakers to help kids nationwide who struggle as a result of having an incarcerated parent. Welcome, Laura.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So, Laura, the Annie E. Casey Foundation has been a longtime advocate for the well-being of children, and you are primarily responsible for the National Kids Count Project with the foundation. Talk about your work with the foundation.
Sure. The Annie Casey Foundation is a national foundation. We're based in Baltimore, Maryland, but we do focus on the issues specifically of kids. We're actually the largest foundation in the country that's focused on kids specifically. And we do that through a lens of really that kids can't really succeed unless their families are stable and healthy and they live in communities where they can really thrive, communities that are good places to raise kids. So although we are focused on kids, we really look at that in a very holistic way. The Kids Count work is actually the longest running project at Casey. We've been doing the Kids Count data book, our national data book, which actually the 2016 data book will be coming out in June. We've been doing that report since 1990. So most of the time, if anybody's heard about Kids Count, at the national level, they've heard about our state rankings that we do in terms of child well-being. And we've been doing it all this time because we really think that there's a real power in tracking children's well-being and lifting up how states are doing in terms of supporting their kids and doing that consistently over time. You know, we really believe that having solid, non-biased data to point to can help policymakers make better decisions that can better support kids and families.
Do the policymakers ask for these reports and follow your recommendations?
Well, sometimes. Because we've been doing Kids Count for so long, we're pretty well respected across the country. And, you know, of course, not with every single policymaker. And people are new every year coming into state legislatures and into city government. But we really do pride ourselves on using data that is non-biased. We get data from the federal statistical agencies or from the school departments. We don't create our own data sets. We, at the Casey Foundation, produce reports and data, but we also work with a network of organizations across the country who do the Kids Count work at the local level. In Oregon, it's Children First for Oregon, and we work with them to help them be able to gather data from state agencies and other local sources to be able to really provide information down to the local level so that if people are working, let's say, in a school district, testifying in front of a school board on a particular issue, they can actually go and find out how many kids are graduating on time in that school district, or how many teen parents there are. And so we find that that data can really help people to be able to make their case for why it's important to invest in kids.
And speaking of reports, in April 2016, the Annie E. Casey Foundation released a report called A Shared Sentence, A Devastating Toll of Parental Incarceration on Kids, Families, and Communities. Laura, what prompted this report?
Well, we have, over the last few years, we've been releasing reports that are focused on policy issues that we think are critical for child well-being. And this particular issue, the issue of the impact of mass incarceration on kids, is something that we've been paying attention to for a long time. It's not a new phenomenon, certainly, but there's a lot of momentum around this topic, both at the national and the state level. And most of it has been focused on sentencing reform, which is absolutely the right thing to be focused on. It's important to stop the pipeline of people coming into prisons. But what we didn't hear within those debates and that conversation was, so why does it matter for the next generation? What's the impact of mass incarceration on kids and on their families? And so we spent some time taking a look at the most recent data and research that exists out there around this topic. And what we found is that having a parent in prison can have major devastating effects on kids, and that there's really been a whole generation of children who have been severely impacted by the mass incarceration that's happened in our country. There's a lot that happens to kids in terms of their own kind of their own development. Having a parent in prison creates a big vacuum in a child's life. They often suffer a sentence along with their parents. Many of them feel very isolated. They feel that there's no other kids or other people that they know that are having the same thing happen to them. A lot of times they feel ashamed that they have a parent in prison. And so this tends to really isolate them from their other kids and the support systems that they need where they live. And some of the research even said that having a parent locked up is a traumatic experience equal to some forms of child abuse, domestic violence, divorce. So it really can have significant impacts on really the child's healthy development, which is why it matters so much to us.
And your report says that nationally, over 5 million kids have had a parent in jail or prison at some point in their childhood. That's a lot of kids.
Yeah, it is. It is about 7% of all kids in the country. And it's actually, we expect that that's a pretty low conservative estimate, because it only captures those children who have had a parent who was incarcerated in their lifetime, but it was a parent who had lived with them at some point. So it's likely that there are many more children who have had a parent who they never lived with that parent, but the parent has been in prison. So, which has lots of implications. Even though that parent didn't live with that child, the likelihood that they would have been able to be more connected to the parent if they were not in prison is a lot higher. So that 5 million number, we think, is a fairly low estimate. It's actually probably even higher than that.
Kids with parents in prison, they are impacted in nearly every aspect of their lives. Talk a little bit more about some of these unique stressors for children of prisoners.
We know that there are certainly major emotional implications for a child. The child's life becomes more unstable. Thinking about financially, we know that there's a pretty substantial impact. Losing a parent, especially one that's a breadwinner for a prolonged period of time, really puts families in a place where they're really scrambling to cover their basic needs. And on top of that, there's legal fees, there's court fees. So one report estimated that 65% of families with a member in prison can't meet their basic needs. That's 2 out of 3 of families who have somebody in prison are having a hard time making ends meet. And another estimate suggested that when fathers are incarcerated, the average family income drops by about a quarter, about 22%. So it's a pretty dramatic economic impact on that family. And then on top of that, one of the things that we uncovered, and this is kind of connected to some of our recommendations on what can be done to lessen the impact on children, is the fact that oftentimes people are put in prison places that are very far from where they live and where their families remain most of the time. So in order to get to visit that person or even to stay in contact with them, it costs money. There are some of the families that we talked to, you know, estimated that it would literally have been hundreds of dollars for them to be able to visit their family member who was incarcerated with their kids, you know, because they needed to pay for transportation, they needed to get a hotel room in order to stay overnight because it was too far to be able to drive. Maybe, you know, if they didn't have a car, they had to pay for the bus. So the cost, and then there's the legal fees, which are most of the time pretty substantial that families undertake. So there's definitely an economic impact on children. And we know from the research that when kids are in economically unstable households, that impacts their development in a lot of different ways, especially when they are, you know, very low-income households, when they're below the poverty line. There's plenty of research to show the ways that can impact a child's development, and it's not positive.
Does your report talk about a parent or a family member stepping in versus a child going to the foster care system?
We did talk a little bit about that. I think certainly that becomes a major issue, especially when mothers are incarcerated.
Right.
And actually, one of the things that we lifted up in our report is that the likelihood that a child is impacted is higher in states where female incarceration rates are higher. So places like Oklahoma, which has the highest female incarceration rate, has got one of the highest rates of kids impacted by parental incarceration. So especially the way that we measured it here, which is the resident parent. But oftentimes, if it's a single parent and that person gets put into the prison system, oftentimes there are relatives that will step in. Many times they won't officially go into the foster care system, and they'll kind of go into this informal system of foster care, which means often that they don't get any help with paying for having that child in their household. And many of them are grandparents who may be on a fixed income. So for them, having the extra economic stress of taking care of that child can be really difficult. We are strong believers in the fact that if children can stay with their families, they're going to be better off, that going into the foster care system, especially if they go in and they have to go into a group home or something like that, is not going to be the best outcome for that child, that they're generally better off if they can stay with their families. But there needs to be some recognition that it's expensive and that those family members need to be supported in some ways to help them be able to take care of that child.
And I've read that incarcerated fathers make up 90% of incarcerated parents. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's about right. That's right.
Talk more about the difference for the child depending on whether the mother and father is incarcerated.
Right. If it's a single-parent household and that parent gets put into the prison system, that child has a major impact on their lives. If it's a parent who is less engaged with that child and maybe not living with the child at the time, but they may be financially supporting the child and interacting with them in some way, you know, that has a different kind of an impact. You know, the other thing I think that is important, even if the parent was not living with the child when they were incarcerated, and even if the relationship was not as, you know, strong as maybe we would have liked it to be, that having that parent incarcerated still has a big impact on the child. And it really does create a vacuum for them in terms of not having a parent. I mean, it's really as if they've lost their parent completely. It's a real hole in their lives.
And Laura, often when an uninvolved parent does go to prison, they decide to begin to reach out to their children.
Some definitely certainly do that. I think there's also the flip side of that, which is that fathers and mothers who have been incarcerated have got very mixed feelings about bringing their kids back into their lives or bringing them into their current situation within the prisons. That most of the time, I think, you know, one of the things that we lifted up here as a real issue is that the visiting rooms within prisons are not places most of the time that are suitable for children. A lot of parents decide, I don't want my kid coming in this place, and choose to, you know, to detach in lots of ways. And oftentimes they can't even do phone calls because the phone calls tend to be, in some places, extraordinarily expensive. There's actually all kinds of extra fees that are put on calls that are made into the prison system, so families can't even afford to call. So, you know, I think it has mixed impacts depending on the family situation.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO 90.7 FM. I'm Karen James, and I'm speaking with Laura Speer, Associate Director at the Annie E. Casey Foundation, and we're discussing mass incarceration in the United States and its impact on children. So, Laura, the Annie E. Casey Foundation report, A Shared Sentence, The Devastating Toll of Parental Incarceration on Kids, Families, and Communities, it does discuss racial disparities. Talk about that.
Unfortunately, I think it's relatively well known that mass incarceration in our country has not impacted all communities equally. What we found is that for children who have incarcerated parents, the rates are significantly higher for kids of color. This is especially true for African American, Latino, and American Indian kids. And it's a fairly dramatic difference just in terms of the likelihood that they're going to be impacted by this. And the other thing I would say is that even if the child themselves and that family in their own family unit hasn't been specifically impacted by this, the places where people live also kind of show the results of disproportionate impacts. And one of the things that we lifted up in this report is how individual communities and neighborhoods are impacted in such a dramatically different way depending on where you live. And unfortunately, for the most part, neighborhoods that are disproportionately African American, especially those that are in urban areas, tend to be impacted in a much more dramatic way. And the way this plays itself out is that there's oftentimes thousands of men who are absent from the neighborhoods. And there's also the impact of them coming back in to the communities after they're in prison. Oftentimes it's a lot harder, and we detailed all the ways that it's harder for people to get jobs when they come out of prison and what can be done to help that. But they come back into the communities and oftentimes are not in a place where they can immediately be contributors to that community. So even the neighborhoods that families live in can make a big difference in terms of how much this particular issue is going to impact them.
So let's talk about the recommendations of the report, Laura. What are you recommending to our judges, communities, the states?
We start with talking about the importance of ensuring that children are supported while the parents are incarcerated and after they return. That there's lots that can be done to help to ensure that children can stay in contact with their parents while they're incarcerated. And we specifically suggest that judges can consider the impact on kids and families when making sentencing and prison assignment decisions. And this is kind of comes down to this, the idea that when people are put into prisons that are geographically farther from where they live, it makes it a lot more difficult for their families to stay in contact with them.
But isn't that more the prison decision than the judge's decision?
The judges can recommend the assignments in terms of what types of facilities they may need to go to.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, just taking into consideration even that they have children.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the other part of that is to require that courts inform local social service agencies and other, you know, community-based organizations that have the capacity to support families that are impacted by incarceration, that the courts inform them when a parent is incarcerated so that they can connect with the families. Because a lot of, I think, what we're trying to do is to just raise this residual impact of the incarceration choices as something that's important for judges and other people within the prison and judicial system to take into consideration.
And in 2010, the Washington State Legislature, they approved a bill that was supported by the Department of Corrections and the Department of Social and Health Services that created two alternatives to prison confinement for nonviolent offenders who have minor children. They're either taking them out of prison early or keeping them in the community so they can be connected to their children. Do you find this across the country? that more and more states are adopting this type of alternative sentencing?
Alternative sentencing is happening. There is a, thankfully, a, you know, it feels at least that we've peaked out, at least for the moment, in terms of the incarceration rates in the country, that there has been a turning of the curve in some way in terms of how frequently we incarcerate adults and especially juveniles. And we actually focus, a lot of our work is focused on the juvenile incarceration, juvenile justice system here at the Casey Foundation. But that's a good thing. I mean, there are lots of ways that that can have positive impacts. And I think pointing to the issue around whether or not that person is a parent and taking into consideration that they have children in making the sentencing decision is absolutely the right thing to do.
And you did talk about, when you spoke about racial disparities, about people coming out of prison, and a lot of times they are going back to the same communities that they got in trouble in the first place, and nothing's changed. Talk about some of the recommendations around employment and trying to keep families together once the person is released back to their community.
We feel like that there are lots of good examples of ways that states and localities can really make a difference in terms of helping people, connecting parents who have returned to their communities with employment especially. So some of the things that are being done across the country, certainly the minimizing the effects of a criminal record through ban the box policies are getting a lot of attention at the national and the state level. This is where, those who don't know, where you ban having to check a box on an application on whether or not you have been convicted of a felony. And also, there's a lot that can be done in terms of directing education and training towards really in-demand jobs for incarcerated people who, while they're in prison, but also when they come out. There's a lot of federal funding that's available to help do that, but it's incumbent on us as a society to not just having these folks return, but having them be able to return and be productive members of society.
Are there any states that you can point to that are doing a better job around helping children of prisoners?
So we actually have examples in our report of states across the country that are really doing things in different ways that can make a big difference. One place that we lift up is New York State, where they've actually taken the tact of really having more child-friendly environments through family centers and prison visiting rooms where parents can visit their child. And they also offer parenting courses and individual and family counseling in those places. So to keep that connection to the child while the parent is incarcerated. Another, this is actually a national program that's in 25 states, in Alabama, Florida, New Jersey, Virginia. It's a couple places where it exists, which is the National Fatherhood Initiative's Inside Out Dads program, which helps the fathers to connect with their families and to build parenting skills. So it allows those parents to continue to be connected. There's actually an example in Oregon, and this is around the private landlords, you know, not being able to discriminate against a person's arrest record or certain type of convictions, that there's, you know, a legal precedent in the state of Oregon. This is something that's just recently been lifted up by the director of the Housing and Urban Development Department at the federal level, letting people know that this is something that shouldn't be done with public housing and that there's no legal reason for there to be discrimination against people who have got convictions in public housing, but many states, they do actually have restrictions. So this is something that the federal government is trying to push to have there be fewer places where this happens. This can be a major barrier especially towards fathers reconnecting or parents reconnecting with their families who may be in public housing, because if they come back into the household, the family will likely lose their housing. So this is a really important way that states can help people get reconnected to their communities, to their families, I think, which is what we ultimately want to have happen.
Right. And in Oregon also, we have one women's prison, Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. They bring their children inside and they have programs with the children and the parents inside. They have a program, Pathfinders of Oregon. They've had a family preservation project going on in that prison. We have about 1,200 women incarcerated in the Coffee Creek facility. But Laura, a lot of the prison programs around parenting are very limited within at least Oregon's prison system. Even the programs that connect incarcerated women with their children, it takes someone on the outside willing to support that program to bring the child into the prison. So the states can do so much more in offering more programs like those in prison and also alternatives to sentencing to keep the family members with minor children out of the facility itself. Do you find that nationwide?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, we were able to find and lift up a few examples across the country of really good practices that are happening, of programs that are really, you know, kind of shining stars, but they are really few and far between. Even in the places that these programs exist, there's very few that are actually accessible to the whole population of people who are in prison and to all the kids who are impacted by incarceration in the state. So one of the things that I think is it's a positive sort of direction that we're going in as a country, and it can have positive implications for kids whose parents are incarcerated, is this kind of push around the Justice Reinvestment Initiative, where because there are so many states that are focused on reducing the number of people who are incarcerated, there's a lot of money that's going to be saved. It's very expensive for people to be incarcerated. So having there be some way to ensure that some of the money that's being saved is available to make sure that those people who are still in prison are able to be a successful contributing member of society once they get out. I mean, one of the things that we included here was this idea of having, number one, having job training programs while people are in prison, but having them be programs that are for high demand type
jobs,
occupations, like in technology. And there's some examples in some places where they actually are doing that in some prisons. And so, and also having there be some way to incentivize the big employers that are oftentimes in neighborhoods where people are coming out of prison and going back to live, things like hospitals and universities, incentivizing them to hire people who are coming out of prison. And there's lots of successful examples of where these places have been able to do that, and it's really made a big difference for the communities. You know, here in Baltimore, where the neighborhoods that surround Johns Hopkins University are some of the neighborhoods that are impacted most dramatically by incarceration and reentry. And so having a place like Hopkins be a place where people can get jobs that are good jobs, that pay them enough so that they can support their families and kind of stay out of trouble, is a good example of a program that can really help people be successful.
Absolutely. You mentioned Justice Reinvestment, and I just want to mention that in 2013, our Oregon legislature did pass a prison reform package that included Justice Reinvestment funds. The bill flatlined prison growth for 5 years, and that the dollars that were saved were distributed to the Oregon counties, and they are working to help keep people out of prison. Some of the counties, they hired more parole officers to keep these folks in the community, and others invested more into mental health and addictions programs and just more community support to keep these people out of prison.
That's great. And I would hope that folks would also take into consideration the kid and the family component of that, that it's an important part of keeping people in their communities, is making sure that they can stay connected to their families and to their children. It's one of the best ways to keep people, you know, kind of on the straight and narrow. And there are examples of, especially the piece around the mental health, I think that that's an entry to think about parenting. And a lot of people who go into prison have got pretty traumatic life experiences, and many of them don't want to have the same thing happen with their own children. So I think that, you know, that's a real opportunity to be able to support the individual as a person, but then also as a parent.
Laura, how can people get in touch with you?
Well, they can find me through the Annie E. Casey Foundation through the website. It's www.aecf.org. There's lots of information about this report, a lot of data. You know, if they want to check out some of the Kids Count information that's about local communities, you can find it at the data center. It's datacenter.kidscount.org. And you can also follow the Casey Foundation on Twitter, as well as me personally. And my Twitter handle is Laura B. Moore, LauraBMore, on Twitter.
Thank you so much for being my guest tonight, Laura.
I'm happy to do it. Thanks for having me.
I've been speaking with Laura Speer, Associate Director at the Annie E. Casey Foundation. This is Prison Pipeline, and you can listen to previous programs of Prison Pipeline at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. That's as well as tonight's program. Thank you to our engineers, Danielle and Mike. Good night.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Peacemaking and Connection, an experiential weekend workshop with 8 Shields PDX and John Young, taking place June 10th through 12th at the Cedar Ridge Retreat and Conference Center in Vironia, Oregon. The 8 Shields model provides a map to the principles and practices of peacemaking. Many conflicts can be avoided altogether, and conflicts that do arise can be managed with respect for all, with community balance and stability. Again, that's Peacemaking and Connection, an experiential weekend workshop with 8 Shields PDX and John Young, taking place June 10th through 12th at the Cedar Ridge Retreat and Conference Center, 18062 Kesey Road in Vironia, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Prince vs. Bowie Memorial Bike Ride on Saturday, June 11th. Put on some purple, grab your dancing shoes, and a